Finally on the call, we're pleased to have John Taft. He's the head of wealth management for RBC US and a former chairman of SIFMA. He's the author of Stewardship, Lessons Learned from the Lost Culture of Wall Street. So let's move to the panelists. It's incontrovertible that trust in Wall Street and financial service firms, historically tenuous, took a nosedive in the wake of the 2008 recession and its aftermath. Of course, investors have short-term memory, and a bull market can erase many sins, and that may temporarily take away some of the immediate urgency for reform. But still, study after study confirms that consumers and investors have no idea how their advisors are paid. They don't understand the difference between brokers and financial planners. The words commission and fees are equally interchangeable and in many ways equally distressing to them, and they make little distinction of the business models that advisors operate under. In short, investors are overwhelmingly confused and unengaged, and that leads to suspicion and distrust. According to a State Street Corp study last year, a mere 15% of respondents said that financial advisors were trustworthy. So I'm going to open up the panel first to Jack. Jack, that's the groundwork. How does the investment advisory industry overcome those hurdles? Or, more cynically, does the industry benefit from that kind of confusion? What's your view?
My comment would be that we interact with a lot of RIAs and we interact with a lot of investors in what we do, and I would have to say that a lot of top-quality RIAs would like to clarify the differences between fees, commissions, advisors, stockbrokers, fiduciaries, non-fiduciaries. I would also have to say that Wall Street would like to obscure the differences. And so there's one battle at that level. I mean, top-quality RIAs want to clarify, Wall Street that benefits from obscuring. The other issue that's even bigger, and we've dealt with this for years, is how do you help investors who don't know they need help? That is, to me, that is the single biggest issue facing, you know, top quality advisors and the fiduciaries, is helping investors who don't know they need help. They don't even know these issues exist. And when they do hear about it, they hear about it in the form of language like the word fiduciary. What does it mean? Why would you want to hire an RIA, IER? So there's two major challenges sitting here. One is Wall Street and the obscurity that it benefits from, and the second is trying to help people who need help. Big challenge.
And do you have some view on how the industry addresses that latter challenge, helping investors who don't even know they need help?
I think a certain percentage of advisors have educational components to what they do. But the bigger problem is it's not education. I mean, for me to sit there and say I'm a fiduciary and the investor has no idea what that means, education is not the solution. They've got to create value for what they're doing. So when I talk about a fiduciary, highest ethical standard in the industry, RIAs that are the registration to provide advice for fees, they've got to create the value. And so I think a lot of RIAs have got an educational component to what they do, but the missing step in there is creating value for the education so the investor has a clear understanding of how this impacts them. I think that's missing.
Okay. John, I'll turn to you. What's your view? It seems like regulators have an inability to agree on a fiduciary proposal at the moment. Can the industry find its own way to fix this problem of trust? And if so, how? I mean, are the incentives that advisory firms work under, particularly on the broker side, too skewed to really foster trust?
I assume you're asking John Taft that question.
I am.
Okay. Yes. First of all, I'd like to point out that the distinction between that the previous panelist made between quote unquote Wall Street and RIAs is a false distinction. I agreed with many of the points that you made in your introduction and that Jack made in his comments, but it's important to realize I run a wealth management firm that does business inside the legal shell of a broker-dealer. More than half of our clients' assets are managed pursuant to investment advisory agreements where the financial advisors who work for me inside our brokerage firm are acting as investment fiduciaries. So Wall Street versus RIAs is a distinction that is misleading and it isn't helpful to the conversation we're having, which is about, and the reason I'm on the call, finding a way to more broadly overlay a fiduciary standard on all investment advice that professionals provide to individual investors as a way to improve investor trust and confidence. That's something that the brokerage industry has supported prior to the writing of Section 913 in the Dodd-Frank Act. So we're on the same page with fiduciary advocates in saying that the way, one way to walk further down the path of restored investor trust and confidence is to come up with a single unified fiduciary standard for anybody who's talking to individuals about their wealth management activities. Where we disagree with the RIA community is that we don't feel, and as somebody who runs a wealth management firm, I know that imposing the fiduciary standard as it has evolved around 40 Act investment advisory, discretionary investment advisory activities, that is not the way to get to a solution. You can't take that particular set of rules and protocols, which work when it comes to discretionary investment and management, and bring it over to the brokerage side of a wealth management firm and say, we're going to impose the same rules on the buying and selling of securities. We're going to impose the same rules on the setting up of trusts, the lending of money, the sweeping of cash into bank deposit vehicles. It doesn't work. So we support a uniform overlay fiduciary standard, but it has to come along with new rules which operationalize that fiduciary standard when it comes to brokerage activities other than the investment advisory activities that advisors are providing to their clients. So that's where we stand, and we think that a fiduciary standard, if we're able to come up with a way to bring it over onto the brokerage side of the equation without compromising client access to products and services or compromising their ability to choose who they work with or how they pay for those services, if we can do that, it will be a major win for everyone.
Great. Okay, we'll follow up on some of that. Michael, let me turn to you. What is your view here? How does the industry overcome some of these issues?
It's a wonderful question. I think if we start refocusing back to why the individuals are coming to us in the first place, a wealth manager, a broker, an advisor, any or all of the above labels, why is it that they're coming to any of these professionals in the first place, which is purportedly to take savings they have, just go with me for this leap for a moment, and to use that savings in a productive manner so that they can achieve some of their goals and objectives, whether it's sending the kids to college, a vacation house, retirement, all of which are their goals. And if we start framing this more as a client-centric work, meaning we're trying to get them from their point A to their desired point B, and we reframe this issue first and foremost as an immunization-style question, and I'm framing it as a question, I'm not talking about LDI right now, as an immunization question, knowing that here is the cost, if you will, in a guaranteed or somewhat likely guaranteed fashion to get to your goal, if we start diversifying into forms of risky assets, then it changes the cost, but it also changes the nature of the guarantee. Now, we can look at that as the tip of the iceberg in some form of education. But if we're talking about training trust, I think we have to start with client-centric work that focuses on what they want to achieve and being candid with them about the costs. You know, if college is going to cost too much, then we don't roll the dice and we don't buy IPO biotech stocks to try and make it happen. We talk about other ways in which maybe you can afford college. I'm just giving that as an example. But the issue is much bigger than just management or management. If you get into the financial planning world, we're talking about all sorts of other types of planning, be it insurance or tax or retirement or estate. And when I give talks, what I find is so many of the high-quality advisors out there are struggling to make the transition from simply getting paid on AUM to how it is they really get paid on their higher value add, which is all of those other types of services. So that's how I'll kick off today, and then we can come back to the challenges, and there's a myriad of challenges with the educational topic that I'm happy to get into.
Okay, great. Jack, and we will get into that, but Jack, let me come back to you with some of John's points. Is it possible to bring a fiduciary standard that would restore trust among investors to the brokerage world, particularly to the Wall Street brokerage world?
I think if the foundation is full disclosure, transparency, and it's conducted in a way that really benefits the investor, then I would say yes. Let me give you an example. We did some research on a firm, and they basically were very proud of the fact that they provided full transparency to the investor. And when we asked them how that transparency was provided to the investor, they basically said, well, the information is on our website, the information is in our terms of service document, and the information is on our ADV at the SEC. I pointed out that that really isn't transparency because we know no investor goes to the ADV and less than 5% of investors read terms of service documents. What I suggested was, you know, when you think about full disclosure, why can't you boil it down to one page and deliver that one page to every investor when you sit down and talk to them, who you are, how you're licensed, how you're compensated, what kind of advice you provide, you know, what's your compliance record. I mean, every high-quality advisor in America could provide full transparency on an 8.5 by 11 document. The investor has seen the document. They've read the document in the presence of the advisor. If they have any questions, they could ask those questions right on the spot. That, to me, is the form of transparency that would be very, user-friendly. But to sit back and say that we practice disclosure, but all that disclosure is contained in a sales pitch where the investor has absolutely no record of what was communicated to them, or the disclosure is sitting in an ADV that the investor doesn't know exists, or a terms of service document that was drafted by an attorney, I think what advisors have to get down to is, if I'm really going to practice transparency, I have to boil it down to an 8.5 by 11, and I have to present it to the investor myself, and I have to be able to explain the information that's on that document. At that point, you have transparency, and that transparency is in a form that benefits investors, and that form that benefits the investor is what would produce the trust.
John, how about that? Is this purely a question of transparency and disclosure? Is that all that's needed, more clear transparency and disclosure to regain the trust of the investing public?
Well, it's a good start. I would agree with that. And I would agree that in almost every area of our industry, financial services industry. And I'm going to, from insurance to banking to brokerage to asset management, the disclosure that's provided, both the words and the vehicles in which the words are contained, is completely misaligned with the ability of consumers of financial services to understand it. I mean, I think that is a major problem. There are a lot of reasons for that. It's that, you know, risk managers, lawyers, compliance officers are looking to protect the financial services firms from, you know, exposure. And extensive disclosure. I mean, you look on TV when you buy a, you know, I don't know, headache medicine. You see three photographs, you know, buy XYZ medication, and then the next 30 seconds are, you know, a warning to whoever's watching the commercial that this could cause diarrhea, vomiting, dizziness, heart attack. I mean, that's what we've come to. It's not just in our industry, but it's not helpful. So I agree with the comment. More transparent, more understandable, simpler disclosure of let's just start with fees and charges. You could even go on to say, and conflicts would help. But we're so far away from, you know, where we need to be on that front. A lot of work would have to be invested to get there. However, I do think Jack is right. It's a good first step.
Okay, great. Michael, what about you on the discussion of disclosure and transparency? I mean, it seems to me that these things are, you know, disclosure, transparency, these are kind of subjective things to gauge. And in practice, it's kind of difficult to engage its true intent or effectiveness. You know, many advisors, you know, want to practice selective disclosure. Where do you come down on that?
Well, we've used the metaphors that it's a good first step with both Jack and John, and I'm going to agree with the fact that it's a good first step. But there are miles ahead before you can get to a destination that is effective. So one step in, oh, I don't know how many steps in a mile or multiple miles. Let's start with the simple premise that the reason somebody's coming to one of these professionals, one of these practitioners in the first place, because they don't know how to do this. If we start with that simple understanding, that framing of the issue, the practitioner or professional can put the most glorious one page of transparent disclosure, I'll merge the terms, in front of the person. They can ask them to read it. They can answer questions the individual has. Well, we can go into school. How many times do students, after a lesson is taught, ask a question? They don't, because they don't want to look foolish. And in this type of a relationship, the advisor or practitioner is the authority figure in that action of disclosure or transparency. The person clearly doesn't know what they're doing, or they may not even be in that office in the first place. They may know enough to know that they do need help, which is a positive step for them, that they don't know as much as they need to do this well for themselves. Great. They acknowledge they need quality help. But now, in the face of an authority figure, a professional, they're not going to ask the right questions. They don't necessarily know the right questions. There are a number of conflicts that always come into play. Number one is, if this is how the advisor or practitioner is going to earn their living, you're asking for them to be objective about maybe what they can or cannot deliver. I'm not saying that they are conflicted. What I'm saying is they have natural conflicts. So this is the first step in what are a lot of steps.
Yeah, you've spoken before about how the financial planning, as the business model exists on the financial planning side, financial advisors themselves have to be honest about what their capabilities.
Yeah. Do they even know what their capabilities are?
Right.
Right? And how much are their capabilities dependent upon their potential income? Right? If people don't want to pay you for helping them buy the right life insurance policy, or people don't want to pay you for counseling them when a 2008, 2009 is happening in the markets, but you can't outperform an index fund. You know, now you have to charge for active managers to try and to beat an index fund, or charge for your asset allocation to try and do better. You may do better, you may not, but your real value is for those other pieces of the equation. And the value proposition with the clients, I think, really needs to be made better than it typically does.
Got it. Okay, follow up on that. Now, I'm going to encourage the panelists to feel free to speak to one another here. And again, if anyone who's listening has a question, feel free to send it to david.armstrong@penton.com, P-E-N-T-O-N.com, and we'll get to it. Again, feel free to speak to each other here. We said that, you know, disclosure is we're miles away from that. The fiduciary rule, is this a problem that can be solved by regulation alone? I mean, it seems that the industry evolves far faster than the regulators can move. That's clear. Witness the rise of the hybrid advisor. John talked about the rise of fee-based assets inside a traditional brokerage. You know, is it possible that regulators could do more harm than good with a bad rule, bad fiduciary rule?
Well, I'll jump in here. It's John Taft. First of all, absolutely. You can write a fiduciary standard the right way, so that everybody wins, and you can write a fiduciary standard so that it does more harm than good. As a fiduciary standard itself is an answer to all your problems. I testified in front of Congress in 2010 on a fiduciary standard in support of a fiduciary standard of care. And the question I got from the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank was chairing it at the time, was all about, you know, will this prevent another Madoff? Well, as we know, Madoff was a registered investment advisor. He was acting under, he was subject to a fiduciary standard of care. And the answer is absolutely not. A mere regulation isn't enough to prevent fraud and activities that are counter to clients' best interests. So he's the classic example of where a fiduciary standard isn't ultimately the answer. It's a step, or as we talked of, one stone in the path, but it's not the end. You, ultimately, and this is what I wrote my book about, it's about stewardship, about how that should be the core principle for the underlying premise, the mission and purpose of the financial services industry. You define the word stewardship, it's responsibly managing what others have entrusted to your care. That's what we should be about. I haven't lived long enough to tell you whether that's ever been at the core of Wall Street or segments of the financial services industry, but that's where we need to get to, and we need to keep at the front and center. Client centricity is an offshoot of stewardship approach to our industry, and we need to get back to that if we're ever going to restore investor trust and confidence. Rules and regulations will only get you so far. It has to come from the ethic that infuses our industry, and unfortunately, as we demonstrate time and time again, have and continue to, we have lost touch with that stewardship, mission, purpose, and responsibility, and we've yet to find our way back.
Jack, let me turn it to you. How do you respond to something like that? Madoff was an RIA?
I think stewardship is probably gone forever. I think that if you look at this from a historical perspective, back when a stockbroker was called a customer's man, basically referencing the advice when they're buying and selling stocks, that advice was always supposed to be in the customer's best interest. all of that got derailed in 1975 when they deregulated commission rates, and all of a sudden you could no longer make a good living being a traditional stockbroker, and stockbrokers became salesmen for mutual funds and other types of products. And then the whole measuring stick became production and the amount of revenue that you generated. It affected which office you got, how much money you made, the kind of esteem of others within your own organization. So I think if you go back historically, there was a point where perhaps a form of stewardship was in play. I think a lot of that got derailed as a very powerful sales culture took over on Wall Street, probably precipitated by the deregulation of interest rates and how people made money. I think when you look at doing what's best for your clients, sitting there, that is a fairly vague standard, keeping in mind we're talking about, you know, an industry where, you know, advisors do not have legitimate track records, so an investor has no way to measure their past results. There's really no significant form of mandatory disclosure, or we wouldn't even be probably having this conversation. So if you were the typical investor, and for what it's worth, I almost feel like I represent investor interests in this type of discussion. I'm an investor, and somebody's trying to sell me their advice and services, and they can't document past results, and there really is no significant mandatory disclosure. It's up to me to ask the right questions. It's up to me to know good answers from bad ones. And at our firm, we, you know, we survey, have major investor surveys four times a year, and I would say less than 5% of investors know the right questions to ask, and they certainly don't know good answers from bad ones, especially if they're up against a skilled salesman who knows what they want to hear, knows how to position himself as a investment expert, even if it's not true. So the investor is up against the 800-pound gorilla, which could be this skilled salesman who's telling the investor, I'm an expert in my field, telling the investor I'm a planner or an advisor, even though they're truly a salesman. And that skilled salesman uses those skills to obscure issues like how they're compensated, what the total expenses to the investor is going to be. So I think when you look at it from a stewardship point of view, you know, I think it used to be there. I don't think it's there now. I think the dominant culture is sales. I think from studies that we've done, somewhere between 5 and 10% of advisors really adhere to a fiduciary standard that really, most of the time, let's say, put the investor's interests first. But even those advisors are not very proactive in promoting the whole concept of a fiduciary standard. You know, they talk about transparency, but as somebody said a minute ago, you know, they provide selective transparency. They basically tell investors what will help them win the relationship, that they disclose any potential weaknesses, that information withheld, and it's the investor's responsibility to be able to uncover that, knowing full well no investor on earth has that type of knowledge. So I think stewardship is a very, very admirable goal. But as somebody said, you know, it's the first step in a miles-long
Right.
Well, not to step on Michael's toes, but I have to come back at that because I want to throw something out and then we can address it more. I have a very different historical perspective. I've been in the industry now almost 35 years, and one of the things that I don't think is appreciated is how far the wealth management advisory business, you know, the wealth management business, the old stockbroker become investment advisor, become holistic wealth manager, has evolved along the continuum from salesman to professional. And there is, my money is managed holistically There isn't anything that I do in my financial life that isn't managed by a team of female advisors at my firm. They are quintessential professionals, and they provide a broad range of look at the way they conduct their business, including starting out every relationship by going through a long-form planning process. Where are you trying to get? What are your goals? What's your risk tolerance? You know, who do you want to involve in the planning process, so forth and so on, including that, and then all the different products and services they offer. And I compare that to the salesman on the bond desk of the brokerage firm I started working for in 35 years ago, and there's no comparison between the professionalism of the people who are managing my money today and the salesperson of several decades ago. So my perspective is very different from Jack's. I actually think we have made a lot of progress, and I can come back to that, but again, Michael, I'm probably taking your turn at the podium.
Oh, I don't know if it is that you're taking my turn, so not to worry about that. I think you're both right. I don't think we have to choose one versus the other. There are parts of this industry that are undoubtedly better, more professional, more skilled than individuals in the past. And I would like to think that those individuals in the past that didn't aspire to continuous improvement, to gain those better, higher levels of skills, that hopefully they're just retired happily at this point, that they're not still, trolling around somewhere in the industry. But back to this point, the regulation do enough? Absolutely not. A regulation is not going to regulate behavior. I mean, if only we look at how crowded our prisons are in this country. Let's take it out of the investment services arena. Maybe we can joke because no investment professionals or heads of bank or anything end up in prison because of 08-09, but let's leave that joke aside because that's not nice. Let's come back to the fact that regulations don't stop bad people from necessarily doing bad things. You need three pieces to this puzzle to work. The sad part about that is that's the equivalent of getting the trifecta at the race course. You need the professional who's doing the work to have a high level of ethics and integrity. You need the individual who is the client of the professional to have enough of a level of understanding of the work that's being done to be able to ask the right questions. That's the bigger hurdle out of those two. And the third part, if something goes wrong, or at least there's a perception that something went wrong, there was a misappropriation, there was bad behavior, there was a bad this or that, then we have to have a process. And I'm not certain that the arbitration process, the way it is today, is the one that we are better off or best off with. We need to have a process in which relatively quickly the client and the professional can get past whatever occurred with as fair a judgment as there can be, comes down, or some combination for one or both of those individuals. So the regulation itself isn't going to stop the professional from needing to have ethics and integrity, just to review again, the client from needing to have a minimum level of understanding, and a process at the back end when and if something goes wrong that can work relatively quickly to repair or at least to clear up what may have gone wrong. Those are the three pieces of the puzzle that are required. But the challenge here that we're kind of all dancing around is this kind of educational component. You know, we don't want to point the finger and say to the client, well, it is your fault that you took my recommendation and the investment lost money, right? We don't want to point the finger at the client. But the client does need to have some minimum level of understanding of what it is they may or may not be accepting for their portfolio. And I'm using portfolio as a general term that could be more than just their liquid investments. It could be trusts. It could be insurance policies. And to expect an advisor to be responsible for educating their clients and prospects, perhaps to the level they need to be, I think is an unreasonable expectation. Unreasonable because it's very difficult and time-consuming. If we want to make a regulation for in any way for the industry, why don't we start with a financial planning 101 course that is mandatory in all high schools?
Okay, Michael, this is Knut Rostad. I'd like to jump in here for a minute, and I know I've interrupted you a little bit, but I'd like to add a couple of very specific questions to what I've heard from John on the one side and what I've heard from Jack on the other side. And John, you know, I guess there are two or three things that sort of jump out at me in terms of your remarks, and I'd like you to respond to them. First of all, your comment regarding the insignificance of whether a broker or an individual providing advice comes at it from a brokerage setting or an advisory setting. And I'd like you just to comment very quickly on whether the broker's obligation and to the broker-dealer and the issuer is totally irrelevant on this point, because I think we forget sort of a very basic point. The broker does not exist in law and in practice to be there to advise a client and represent a client.
Well, Newt, let me finish, please.
As opposed to an advisor who does exist to represent the client. So that's the first question. The second question is regards your strong statement that broker dealers are for a uniform fiduciary standard. And if when you mean by that, do you think of the standard that has been so clearly articulated by SIFMA over the last 3 or 4 years? I go back to their July 2011 letter, and so that is the second question. And if that is true, then I want to jump in and I want to ask you about 3 or 4 points in terms of what SIFMA's position is, and I'd like you to explain to us and explain to the listeners how those positions can be consistent with the statement or claim that we're working in the client's best interest. So if you could answer those first two questions, and then we'll go to the third, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I'm going to go back to my wealth managers. And when I walk into the office of my wealth managers, I expect them to have one thing on their agenda, and that is helping me manage my wealth. I expect them to have my best interests at heart from the minute I walk in their office to the minute I walk out. Okay, but as a practical matter, from a regulatory standpoint, when we talk about a series of portfolios that they manage for me on a discretionary basis, either directly or through third-party managers, they put on a white hat, your white hat, and they are investment fiduciaries. They're operating pursuant to investment advisory agreements, and they are subject to a fiduciary standard. Then we go and we talk about,
You're talking about your registered brokers on that point?
No, my financial advisors who work for the broker-dealer that I run.
Thank you.
Manage money for me discretionarily as registered investment advisors subject to a fiduciary standard. Okay? Then we finish talking about my equity portfolios. And we talk about my bond portfolio. Now, I invest in municipal bonds. I know a lot about it. I ran a mutual fund company that was a muni bond company, and I was an investment banker who designed and issued municipal bonds. I know a lot about that area. I don't want to pay anybody to manage my municipal bond portfolio. So I ask my financial advisors to build me a bond ladder with bonds maturing every year 1 to 7 years out. I want them to find the best bonds they have in the state of Minnesota, where I pay income taxes. And 90% of the time, my firm owns those bonds in our inventory. So my advisors call me up and they say, we own, you know, state of Minnesota geo bonds due 2020. Here's the value, here's the price, here's the yield. Do you want to buy them? Yes, I do. They buy those bonds from my broker-dealer acting as principal in violation of a fiduciary standard. Okay, they couldn't do that if you imposed the 40 Act fiduciary standard on that activity. Does that mean that my broker has just taken off the white hat of acting in my interests and put on a black hat where they're looking to screw me on the trade they just made in my bond portfolio? And now we're going to go talk about my insurance trust. And now we're going to go talk about my loans that are secured by my bond portfolio. My point is that I expect my financial advisors to have my best interests at heart across all those activities. But regulatorily, they're fiduciaries only with respect to one of the activities that they engage in on my behalf. That doesn't make any sense. So to answer your question, would they put their hand in the air and sign up for a fiduciary standard that applied to all those activities? Absolutely. Would they sign up for a fiduciary standard that told them they could no longer construct a bond portfolio made up of municipal bonds that they purchased for me out of our firm's inventory because that principal transaction was a prohibited transaction? They would not sign up for that fiduciary standard. In one case, the right way. In one case, the wrong way.
And the reason they wouldn't sign up for that is because in their capacity in terms of the principal trades, it's been determined that that is so conflicted that by nature it should not be part of being a fiduciary. They can do that all day long as a broker, and God bless them for doing that. But all one would suggest is that they don't do that as a fiduciary.
Okay, I totally disagree with what you're saying because this is where misinformation makes the job harder, not easier. Okay, so actually it does turn out, as I'm sure you know, that if you're managing money discretionarily for a client, you can engage in a principal transaction. You can engage in a principal transaction if you disclose to the client that you are, and the client agrees to that trade before it happens in writing. So you can do that inside a discretionary investment management account, which points out that a fiduciary standard is not a no-conflict standard. A fiduciary standard is a standard in which conflicts are disclosed and they are not acted upon unless the client accepts and waives the conflict. Okay, the mere charging of a fee is a conflicted activity.
John, do you get informed written client consent every time when those conflicts are disclosed?
Any time that a principal trade is made inside a discretionary investment advisory account, I do. I don't in my bond account because I haven't asked for it. But let's say we said, okay, we're going to impose a fiduciary standard on my broker when it comes to buying me and municipal bonds and setting up a bond ladder. And a requirement of that fiduciary standard for that activity, operationalized for that activity, is that my client discloses to me that from time to time I will buy bonds for you from the firm's inventory. We will be acting as principal. That is a conflict. Do you accept that conflict? I would say absolutely, all day long. Why? Because I know I will get better bonds at better prices and better yields if I accept that conflict than if I require my broker to go out in the marketplace and troll for bonds on an agency basis. So there's an example where it's simple to operationalize a fiduciary standard and apply it to a brokerage activity. It works in my best interests. And there, if you just go activity by activity and perform that work, you can get to a fiduciary standard that works in a brokerage context. But if you go over to the investment advisor world, I'm not done. If you go over to the investment advisory world and just say we want to apply the one-size-fits-all investment advisor fiduciary protocol to brokerage activities, it's a non-starter. And that's where you guys are stuck. You won't move off that position.
Well, it's not, John, it's not that we are stuck about it. It's been stuck like that for generations and generations. And with, I think what we are reflecting is that background. But I just want to clarify one point. The disclosure that you're getting, is that a blanket disclosure that you're talking about just now? That's a blanket disclosure, correct?
For what?
For
the bond account?
About? Yeah.
It doesn't exist, so we'd have to design it. But, yeah, I would say annually renewable.
Yeah.
Disclosure and acceptance of the fact that when my advisor is building, making trades in my bond account, they are doing so as principal. They are conflicted. Right. I accept and waive that conflict.
Which the SEC for years said that was inadequate but has changed their view over time. But if you go back to Arlene Hughes, that's the position there. Finally, and I know I'm taking up the clock here, but in terms of being specific, in terms of what else, in your view, John, is appropriate for fiduciary in the brokerage environment, is it fair to assume that you agree with the position that SIFMA has put out there as of 3 years ago, or not? Is that fair or not?
I was the architect of that statement. Of course, I agree with it.
Well,
I testified in favor of it in front of Congress.
I know you did, John. I know you did. I remember
but
the time.
What's your question?
No, because, John, I didn't want to assume that your position as an individual executive was exactly the same as SIFMA's. So I would.
It is. We support a fiduciary standard.
Yeah, okay.
Of care.
No, because I want to touch on about 3 points on that position, and I'd like you to. I think it'd be very good if you were able to explain it. And the first point has to do with the position on conflicts of interest. And in SIFMA's letter, they chide the SEC for urging advisors to avoid conflicts of interest. And they go further to suggest that conflicted advice can be advantageous to clients. So that's the one point. The second point is, in terms of precisely what is covered by your notion of uniform fiduciary standard in the SIFMA position, it's very specific about the language that must be used from the advisor to the client to be included as being covered by your version of uniform fiduciary standard. And it really comes down to when you use the words, Mr. Jones, I recommend X. And so it's a very narrow view. And so I'd like you to explain why it's appropriate that your advisor can sit in front of a client and speak for 10 minutes and only have one or two of those minutes, hypothetically, consistent with SIFMA's view, covered as fiduciary language. Then I'd like you to explain, too, I'm almost done, John, but this is really good. I mean, and you're going to be really helpful in your answers here. I know you are. I wish you could explain where or how it's in the client's best interest when the advisor, in your view, should be able by contract to basically narrow out and define what is covered by fiduciary and what is not covered by fiduciary. Because I think when you stand back and you look at the SIFMA's point of view, that, and SIFMA does say this, that this may entail a fact-finding exercise to determine what parts of the language that the advisor broker has used are covered by fiduciary and what parts are not. So now I will let you speak and sort of talk about how those views are consistent with the fiduciary standard.
I got to be honest with you, I forgot the first question. In the course of what was the first one again?
The first question is SIFMA defending the importance of
thank you. Let me use this example.
Hiding the SEC for encouraging people to encouraging advisors to avoid conflicts.
All right, let's use the simple example. Okay, Alibaba is doing is bringing to market one of the largest ever IPOs in history next week. Okay? My client walks in the door, says, and this is happening right now at my firm, demand for shares of Alibaba are unbelievable. Everybody wants to own it. So guess what? We are a co-managing underwriter, RBC, of the Alibaba initial public offering. Under a fiduciary standard that looks, smelled, and felt like the 40 Act standard, or a no-conflicts rule, which you say SIFMA chided the SEC about, we would have to say, sorry, we, RBC, cannot sell you shares of Alibaba. Why? Because, by definition, in an underwriting, we are a principal. We are conflicted. You are buying.
Why can't you send them down the hall to your broker?
What's that?
Why can't you send them down the hall to your broker?
We're talking about a fiduciary standard applying to all the brokers at my firm.
John, no one has ever talked about covering every single broker all the time for all their activities. That's what we support.
That's a uniform fiduciary standard, but
that's interesting.
Okay, that's the whole point. Now, what I would say, and where SIFMA is coming from, and they say, actually, engaging in that conflicted activity, i.e., making shares of Alibaba available to our clients, can serve the best interests of our clients. It's what they want. Let's start with that. Alibaba may appreciate in value significantly over time. Let's go there. And so allowing them to buy shares from us may actually be in their interest, even though by definition we are acting in a conflicted way. Okay, that's what that statement is all about. And we're going to run out of time here on the call. I'm going to run out of time. But that's just one of the many examples. The point is this, Newt, that when it comes to brokerage activities, okay, a fiduciary standard has never been written for. A fiduciary standard has never been operationalized so that it protects investors while at the same time allowing financial advisors operating in a brokerage context to be fiduciaries, to raise the bar. And all we're saying at SIFMA is you need to write new rules if you want to bring the fiduciary standard over from the investment advisory world and apply it to brokerage activities, which, as I told you, in my case, my advisors do both things for me. So the purpose of the rule is to have one level of investor protection sitting over the heads of the people who help me manage my wealth. It's not easy to do it. There's no roadmap. We're open to different solutions, but a simple implementation of the 40 Act fiduciary standard in my world doesn't work. That's the point.
John, that's a very good point of being here. I will say just one point very quickly. Your assumption that every singular dealer, you say in your firm, I don't know whether that applies to all brokers, are presumed to be covered. That's a presumption that I don't believe is shared by the vast majority of people out there. In terms of your suggesting that, in a sense, that the brokerage function disappears per se under your vision.
It doesn't disappear. It doesn't disappear, but it's subject to a fiduciary standard.
I want to make sure that I can break in here, because I know we're running out of time, and just wanted to make sure that either Jack or Michael, who had anything to follow up on this, have a chance to speak. Michael, Jack, anything to say?
I'll jump in quick, Jack, just to expedite. Listen, I think that there should be a fiduciary standard that is appropriate for anybody who touches clients' wealth. And you can call that assets and investments. You can talk about real estate. I'm just going to call it wealth. But I want to appreciate it has to be workable and functional for the industry. But that doesn't make it work necessarily. That's the first step. We still need, again, the three pieces. We need ethics and integrity by the practitioner. We need a client to know enough to ask the right questions. And we need a process at the back end. If something goes wrong or is perceived to have gone wrong, to expedite a response, an answer, a solution, whatever that supposed problem was. So even if we have a standard, that's that regulation again. That is in and of it by itself not going to be enough to help us get back to functioning in the best interests for the clients.
Okay, great.
The only thing I would add to that, and this would be maybe a little too cynical, but bottom line is everybody has to make money in this business. And whether my need for money comes ahead of the investor's need to achieve their goals, I think that's an advisor-by-advisor decision. I also do not believe that regardless of any new regulations that might evolve out of all of this, you know, does the regulators really have a strong enforcement capability? Because you get right back to investors not knowing enough to protect their own interests, and whether it's the industry's responsibility to protect them from themselves. And if anybody breaks any rules, I mean, they couldn't catch Bernie Madoff, and I doubt that they would catch advisors that are basically giving advice that is a potential conflict of interest, or the advisor benefits more than the investor. So it's a big conundrum, and there's no simple answers, none.
Agreed. Okay, well, maybe no simple answer, but hopefully we move the ball forward a little bit today. There were a couple questions that came in, but I think we're out of time. It's 3 o'clock, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to forward these questions to the panelists, if they're so inspired, they can respond, and we'll make sure those responses get out to the people who ask the questions. Does that sound good to everybody?
Yeah.
That's fine.
That's fine.
Great. Okay, well, thanks very much, everyone, and thanks for the lively conversation, and we will talk to you again. Have a good afternoon. Hello?